Toi, Dieu.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships at sea, let's go to press.
You are fascinated with sex and you don't care about public policy.
Me?
Now, that's
really?
What I get out of watching you tonight.
I think the media is among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met.
One of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides.
What Boehner is angry with is the American people holding him accountable.
If I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems.
Well, I don't know why that's funny.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Rob Long and Peter Robinson. I'm James Lilacs, and today we have David Frum from The Atlantic. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Welcome, everybody, to this, the Ricochet Podcast, number 326. I'm James Lilacs, and we are all brought to you by Sanebox. You can get your inbox under control if you go to sanebox.com/ricochet, that is. And we're also brought to you by our newest sponsor, Indochino. They make it easy to get great-fitting, high-quality suits and shirts at an incredible price. Go to Indochino.com and enter that coupon code Ricochet at checkout and look like $1 million. And we're brought to you by The Great Courses. Right now, you can get a free month of unlimited access to all the great courses at The Great Lectures. Well, you got to sign up at greatcoursesplus.com/ricochet, of course, but we'll tell you a little bit more about that later. And somehow, we're brought to you by Ricochet itself. Ricochet is brought to you by Ricochet. And if that seems baffling,
it is baffling. Isn't it one of those things you can't do? But we did it. Peter Robinson, who's also here, and I founded Ricochet because we wanted to create a civil place for civil conversation on the web. That's what we do, conversation. If you like what you're listening to on the podcast, we really need you to join Ricochet. It's a great place to sort of read conversations, join them, join groups. It's like imagine Facebook, but for people who aren't screaming at you, or Twitter for people who aren't rude. That's what Ricochet is. We need a bunch more members. We have a little member drive thermometer up at the top of the page, ricochet.com. It's not moving the way we need it to move. And, you know, look, they shut down Vine yesterday. Right? So these things just don't keep going. I mean, I hate to sound so dire, but it isn't like, well, if I don't join, someone else will join and it'll stay. No, what happens is we run out of money and then we stop doing it. So please don't let us do that. If you like what you're listening to, please support us. Join Ricochet. You get a free month. So there's absolutely no risk for you. And while you're at it, you might want to subscribe to Daily Shot, free email, daily blast MZIP in your inbox in the morning. It's a great way to keep tabs on what's important that day and also funny little jokes that you can tell your friends. It's worth it. So we have hundreds of thousands of listeners. We do not need hundreds of thousands of members, but we need more and we need you. So please join today.
My daughter asked why Vine had to go away. Couldn't somebody buy it? Couldn't they put in ads? The cancellation of this particular medium, I mean, the elimination of a medium for her was the most traumatic thing that's happened. And it was a great lesson. These things don't last forever. I was telling her in 2005, 2006, everybody was on MySpace. Gone. Period. Poof.
Yeah. And all the things Friendster.
Right. And all the things you're rattling around on today won't last unless you pay for them.
Right.
You got to pay for content. People don't work for free.
Well, but here's the thing. Well, I hear that, but I always want to say for us, for Ricochet, I mean, I know we're talking about something larger, which I think is good, but it's that we're not really saying content. What we're trying to do is create a space, right? Create a space where you can actually have a conversation between and among the center right, and it's civil. That's what we're trying to do. And but you're right. In general, people don't, they're just not hardwired, I think, since the beginning of the web to pay for anything. And also, there's a lot of nonsense around it. Everything takes time. I mean, people were doing Vines and becoming Vine stars and getting paid money to do these six-second little jokes. I mean, how long is that going to last?
Yeah. Well, Instagram killed the Vine star. And, Peter, I know that you yourself are wondering what next platform is coming up so you can train your smartphone at it and get right in there on the ground floor. But let's turn to something else here, and that is the news that comes to us over our browsers. If you go to CNN.com, if you go to GoogleNews.com, Well, the top story, Google News, is that Trump isn't paying any money to his own account. One of the top stories in News and Buzz at CNN.com is that Lindsay Lohan really is aiding the Syrian refugees. You have to scroll and scroll and scroll and hope to find anything about WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks, yeah. Every day, a new confirmation of just about what people feared. And I now have read enough about verification and signage and codes and all the rest of this to believe that pretty much
they're all real.
The real stuff. The very fact that John Podesta's password was essentially password with a couple of characters altered says all you need to know about these people, brightest minds of their generation. But why isn't this catching on with the electorate? Is it because they're not hearing it, or is it because they've heard it and they've heard it before? They've factored it all in.
My judgment, this is one reason why you still need journalists. They're not hearing it exactly. But the press – oh, I hate to start this because Rob is going to come right after me. Peter, that's the mistake conservatives have been making for a quarter of a century, blaming it all on the press. Well, you know what? I'm blaming this on the press. The bias in favor of Hillary Clinton and against Donald Trump is at a level of bias I don't recall seeing ever before, and I've been monkeying around in politics for a long time now. So there's that. And what is necessary, WikiLeaks is – you know, in my judgment, this almost proves the Russians aren't behind it. It's some kids, some hacker kids someplace, because they're making the terrible mistake of dumping thousands of these things a day, which means nobody, no ordinary person can absorb them. Nobody can find the story unless a reporter reads them. And a reporter says to an editor, hey, here are six really interesting things that we didn't know before, or here's something that confirms something people only suspected. And the editor says, wow. Write that up, put it on page one. You have to have – we still need journalists to report, to figure out what matters in the massive reality coming at us. And I'm sorry to say that – I'm sorry to say because I consider what's going on in WikiLeaks pretty important, but it's just not – the press is not taking it seriously and getting – and framing it on front pages and top of the news the way it deserves to be. That's my judgment.
Before Rob hops in – I just want to tell you, Star Tribune today, top story above the fold, Minnesota poll, 54% say Clinton not truthful about her email. So we went out, asked the question, and the results, unflattering to Clinton, are at the top of the page.
I hand it to the Strip.
But I think that's a very good example of the problem, because I think people, when they see these WikiLeaks, they think, I heard all about these emails. But no, these are different emails. These are not her email. You know what I mean? Like it is such a giant swamp now. The most interesting thing about WikiLeaks.
There's also the feeling. I'll hand it to you. But there's also the feeling, oh, it just tells us what we already know. Well, not really. The revelation yesterday that the Clinton Foundation funneled $66 million worth of business to Bill Clinton personally, that's new. That's new. We sort of knew the whole thing was corrupt, but the extent of the corruption is staggering, and we didn't have that before. Sorry, Rob. Go ahead.
No, I think that's true. I mean, we had the vapor trail of it, and we had the outlines of it. You know, it's like when detectives are saying, "I'm not looking for the clue yet. I'm looking for the things around the clue." We had all of the smoke we needed. I mean, the Clinton Foundation is a corrupt shakedown outfit. It's designed. It's actually kind of amazing that these two people who show zero loyalty to their employees still and have for 25, 30 years, nevertheless managed to get loyal employees willing to work on this sort of smash and grab for them. That's absolutely true. I don't disagree with the bias of the press. And I think one of the reasons that the press at this point is unleashed and worse now is because they all agree that Donald Trump is just awful. And that there is, I mean, he's a thousand degrees more awful than Mitt Romney, who, by the way, they thought was awful too. But in this case, I think really what we're looking at is some inside baseball in a way. The John Podesta email leaks are like, well, who's John Podesta again? Who cares?
Right.
It is, if you are interested in the actual way in which government power and influence is corrupted and turned into money. It is a very thorough dissection of that, even including the names of the companies like Teneo, where they would direct you to go in order to make your case. Now, they are not unique in this. The Clintons are not unique in this. This is what happens in Washington a lot. But we have this.
Nobody's done this. Nobody's done this with the presidency of the United States. Nobody has sold it at this level. The Clintons may not be unique because, in the same sense that in the old days, people were putting together rudimentary automobiles in their barns, and Henry Ford was just making automobiles. But I mean, the scale of the thing is staggering.
Because you have a former president and you have a sitting secretary of state, and they have cabaled together to form this, it's a shakedown outfit. And it's remarkable how efficient it was and how brazen it was, frankly. But I mean, with the idea that the people of influence in D.C. would have be allied with companies, usually consultancies of some kind, that now in the 90s and the aughts became consultancies with private equity attached. So it's vast sums of money, not just $100,000, $200,000 a month monthly retainer fees, but vast, vast sums of capital. And that you would say, well, you know, I get all my advice, if you were a decision maker in D.C., from this company over here. They really helped me sort through the options. And that was the way your aides would wink to the company that is trying to buy influence. They had to buy it through that store. And that a lot of people do that. This, I think, is the most – I mean, it really is if you wanted to teach a class in this, this would be your primary textbook. If you wanted to if you were a newcomer to DC, you know, fresh faced in your new suit, and you were working for Senator so and so, or you were like a young congressman and you were on your way up, and you wanted to know, how does it work? How do I get rich? WikiLeaks is your textbook. That is an MBA in government, graft, greed, influence peddling, and a fantastic get rich scheme.
Just for historical, just to provide a historical touch point here, Spiro Agnew, Vice President of the United States, when he was Governor of Maryland, accepted, as I recall, the figure was $15,000 in a paper bag from a contractor who was got a state contract to build roads someplace in Maryland, as I recall. But the amount was 15 grand, as I recall. It was certainly below 20 grand. It was in a paper bag, and he was forced to resign as Vice President of the United States. And because he himself had a sense of shame, he lived the rest of his life in anonymity. He didn't live it in poverty. He became a businessman, but he went off and began a new life and lived in anonymity. Contrast the simplicity, the almost country bumpkin. That almost sounds like a scene from Huckleberry Finn by comparison with Bill Clinton.
I mean, charming, isn't it? $50,000 in a paper bag.
The nattering nabobs of anonymity. You mentioned the word shame. Yes. I was thinking about this today because there's this firm that company I used to do some stuff for, and they keep sending me checks, and I don't cash them, and I send them back because I don't do anything for them anymore. It wouldn't be any skin off their nose if I cashed them, but I can't ethically because I haven't done anything for them. I haven't worked for them. Bill Clinton got $16 million, I think, for being a nominal chairman of a president of a board of a small school somewhere over 5 years. Didn't do a lick of work for it. He's owed it because he's Bill Clinton. Where's his? There's no shame. None whatsoever. Accumulation of the grossest space. But the deal is, I mean, everybody thinks that this probably is what goes on. What appalls people, if they're appalled at all, is the scale. That's just it. But yeah. I would be happy if they would look at other things besides this. Because we know that there's corruption. This shouldn't surprise anybody. Teapot Dome, Tammany Hall. It's the little things that contradict the official narrative. Like, for example, when you have somebody saying, oh, the president is saying that he never saw these emails. We've got to clean this up because it's obvious that he was responding to stuff that Hillary Clinton said that had her address. We need to clean this up. I love that. That they have to scurry around behind the scenes and fix exactly the president's statements as it resolves with an email. But he wouldn't have to clean it up if he had Sanebox because he does this cleaning.
Oh! That was just superb.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
I'm kind of like – my heart is pounding. I'm like – so I'm stunned.
Well, I just have to tell you that that's the case. If these guys have been using Sanebox, I don't think they would have had a chance, frankly. If you're like a lot of people, if you're like my daughter lamenting Vine, you've got 567,000 emails in your box. I used to have that problem too, and then I got Sanebox. So I no longer have that. I actually have every week or so, inbox zero. That Zen state for which all seem to seek, and Rob Long has had for a long time, and I get there occasionally.
Yeah, I have.
And it's inbox. I knew I wanted to fix my email. I didn't know what I could do about it. But when I hooked up with this, all of a sudden things fell into place. There is Sane Later, which automatically moves the email that you don't need to look at right now into a box you can look at later. You train it. You take my email, you put it over there, and the program learns and adapts to what you tell it. There's also something called the black hole. And the black hole is cool because, he said, answering his phone. The black hole, which I just sent that message to, is something that you drag a letter in there, you're not going to hear from the people again. You will never hear from those spamming individuals ever again in the history of the universe. So it's great. Aside from moving all the junk to the junk folders, you can focus on the stuff that matters. What it'll do is just make you spend less time sorting your email and more time looking at the messages and responding to the people that you really want to. And keeping those conversations going ought to be what email is all about. So Sanebox and Ricochet have worked out a marvelous deal for you, the listener. You can visit sanebox.com/ricochet today, and they will throw in an extra $25 credit on top of the 2-week free trial. You don't have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to buy, so there's nothing to lose and a lot to gain, including your time. Check it out today. Let us know if you like the black hole and reaching inbox zero as much as we all do, and you will. That's sanebox.com/ricochet. And thanks to Sanebox for sponsoring this The Ricochet Podcast, and keeping it going. We now welcome to the podcast David Frum. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine and the chairman of Policy Exchange. 2001 to 2002, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. And you can follow him at Twitter, of course, at David Frum. And you're probably lamenting the end of Twitter's Vines as well, David, all those little six-second videos.
Yeah.
You were a master of the art form, we understand. But
actually, from my wife's point of view, Twitter itself can't go bankrupt fast enough.
Oh, no, really? I think that's probably true. I can imagine, David, it's Rob here in New York. I can imagine Danielle sitting there watching you, because you're a prodigious tweeter, and she must at some point think, hey, put it down, right?
Yeah.
Am I close?
We do have a family life here. You can't stop talking. Stop visible friends.
Yeah, and we do like just a little bit more fatherhood than 140 characters, if you don't mind. Hey, so David, I want to talk about the election soon and what comes after that. Before we do, before you joined us, we were just talking about the astonishing lucid primer in government corruption and especially Clinton corruption that you can see in these WikiLeaks and just how brazen it is. You're a Washington, D.C. kind of guy. Should we be shocked by this? Are we overreacting to it? When you read it, you've got to shrug and say, oh, yeah, everybody does it. Or is this a new level of D.C. corruption?
Jay Leno made a joke back in the 90s. This was when the Monica Lewinsky scandal erupted, distracting attention from the previous Lincoln bedroom scandal. And Jay Leno, who doesn't often make a good joke, but this was a good one, said, just how brilliant it is of Bill Clinton to distract attention from a scandal with another scandal. What happens is they pile offense on offense in a way that makes time seem to elongate. So you lose sense of just how shocking it is. Just to put this in context, the first president of the United States ever to give a speech for money was Gerald Ford, who I think we all were alive to see.
Yes.
And it was shocking. I remember this. I mean, I remember researching it. I read a book that said people were aghast that a president would go somewhere and give a speech. Presidents did that all the time, of course. And then somebody would put an envelope with a check in it in his hand and off he'd go in his golf cart. Horrible. The first president of the United States ever to give a speech for money outside the United States was Ronald Reagan. And he did it, I think, two or three times.
Remember that?
One tour in Japan.
Do you remember that the Japanese tour? It was a scandal. It was a front page story.
It was a huge scandal. Yeah. And he got paid a little over $1 million, which seems like – and I have to say, as a former Reagan staffer, I was a little – and then I realized, oh, he's trying to put some money together quickly for Nancy. He knows his time is limited. In any event, what the motivation was understandable, and the amount now seems minute.
Nonetheless, president had ever gone and taken – foreign money off the soil of the United States before. So when these Clinton – these are innovations. Clinton is not doing something that has been going on, you know, for 100 years. He invented this whole new way to get rich post-presidentially. It is brand new. And it's being copied. Tony Blair followed it. But yeah, it's a scandal. I think the Doug Band memo in particular is like the Clinton Axis Hollywood tape. And it doesn't tell us anything that we didn't sort of know, but it is amazing to hear the confession in the confessor's own voice.
Okay, so it's the Clinton, and as we're talking about this, it's the Clinton Access Hollywood tape. But let's just get real here. The question of what's going to happen in a week is less about, I think, who's going to win, as the size of that win. At least, you know, from my, you know, kind of looking at the polls. Why don't people care about? And I'm not saying as compared to Trump. I mean, I'm not. I think that you and I probably agree on Trump. But I just mean, why? Or put it this way: when she's president, are all these stories going to suddenly come back because the press is they're jackals and they smell and they want to, you know, they want to attack? Or are we just have we reached a new level of indifference to honor and decency in politics?
Well, look. This is the moment where we each get our chance to speak for the great and good American people, and to take and to express through our own, you know, a casual opinion what hundreds of millions of human beings are saying. But okay, I'll bite, and then we can all take turns. I think people do care. But Hillary Clinton, it's like a depressed stock that when Hillary Clinton came to the fore. I mean, why is it that Bernie Sanders, who vies with Ted Cruz, is the most disliked figure in the U.S. Senate, who has no record of any kind, who's like an unfunny Larry David, who's as uncharismatic a politician as and he shellacked her. I mean, and he came within inches of winning. And she, you know, there are all these polls about how untrusted she is and how people think she's a liar and how think she's crooked. And then one of the things we learned from WikiLeaks, and I, by the way, I totally condemn WikiLeaks. I don't like to see the Russians interfering in an American election, but if it's there, I'll read it. What we learn is her own people, the best of her own people, the John Podestas and the Eric Andams, are as horrified as any of us are about what is going on. And her daughter is warning Hillary Clinton, you know, these people who have gathered around you and especially around Dad, these people are, you know, not to be trusted. They're corrupt.
Right.
So and
Chelsea's stopping a little short there. It's mom and dad who are not to be trusted, but still.
but that's an interesting point. I mean, I was talking to somebody recently about you know what the Hillary Clinton administration's going to look like, what it's going to be. And the truth is that most of the old Clinton loyalists from the 90s have gone on to become zillionaires in their own right. And we have 8 years of a Democratic administration, so everybody's exhausted. They're all going to leave. Who's left at the end of that but a whole collection of parasites and lowlifes?
Well, I hope that who's left is Neera Tanden and that she remains as sassy. She seems incredible. I know her a little bit and I have great respect and affection for her, but I have to say, as well as I thought of her, I underestimated her.
The woman is 70 years old practically. Bill Clinton's old. He doesn't look well. Are we looking at the last gasp of a Cosa Nostra called the Clintons? Or are we? What happens when she's the sitting president? And he's a former president. I mean, does their price go up because she's been promoted from Secretary of State? Yes. I mean, I guess what I mean is anyone? Can you imagine a scenario in the future where anybody in this whole pageant goes to jail or is shamed or is in some way driven from office and from the spotlight and from access and from influence? Or is this just if I read the WikiLeaks, I said before you got here, if I read the WikiLeaks and I'm a young person just starting out in D.C., I'm saying this is my roadmap. This is my Go West young man. This is my Dale Carnegie. This is my, think and grow rich. This is my self-help book.
Yeah, I don't think anybody goes to jail because the laws that would outlaw this activity haven't been written yet. You know, when you're a pioneer, you do. You know, it's not illegal because it's not illegal if no one thought of it. Right. No one thought of right. it but before, but you. So
right, they're early monopolists.
Exactly. So no, no one. I don't think anyone will go to prison. And and they take good advice. They no one ever. You know, if you say you don't remember. That's not a lie because go prove that you did. But here I think, you know, what is that administration going to be like? A lot depends on what happens in Congress. If the Republicans hold even one house, look, Hillary Clinton's going to have a lot of initiative, and she's going – one of the early decisions she makes, and this is – we've all got many different stakes in this. The Republican Party post-Trump will be this assemblage of – factions held together by extremely weak leadership. If Hillary Clinton leads early with an immigration initiative, mm-hmm. she destroys that leadership. She can discredit Paul Ryan.
Right.
And the strategic question for her is, which does she prefer? Does she prefer to deal with a weakened Republican Party, or does she want to smash it and then turn it into like a Somalia-like street scene in which there is no government and there are only factions of warring warlords? Right. And which is better for her? And by the way, does she have true? Although she has the initiative, maybe she doesn't have freedom to act because, of course, she has her own party.
Right.
Trust her. I mean, Barack Obama was sort of like a Democratic Reagan, at least in this respect, which is nobody in the party was going to challenge his authority. That won't be true for Hillary Clinton.
I know Peter wants to jump in. I got one more question about that. Isn't part of the bait that you don't want to take, even though it seems immoral not to take it, is that if you're a Republican or just a sort of a good government decency person, don't you kind of want to investigate and come up with laws and rules to sort of govern this so there's not another smash and grab from this kind of cabal? Or is that just what the Clintons want, which is more investigations of us because that's all you Republicans do is investigate us all the time?
Yeah. Look, I don't think you want to investigate ancient stuff. If you're a good government type, I mean, some of the things present really important questions, like the whole question of government emails. And by the way, I am not completely unsympathetic to the part of Hillary's position that was not about we've got a lot of embarrassing goings on at the Clinton Foundation. I need to cover them up. The part of it which is that the president and the secretary of state should be able to communicate in modern ways without feeling that 15 minutes later, three committees of Congress are going to be looking over their shoulders.
I agree with that.
I think there are things we need to do. I think we need to make sure that the executive branch can communicate with itself in confidentiality. And then we need to have some rules about archiving and the systems that people and bringing all of it into the post computer era. So that there are things we need to do. But the most important thing for Republicans, it seems to me, is to put together a real party organization that can stand up to these outside raiders like Donald Trump.
Hey, David, Peter here. Corruption, and then your piece in the Atlantic, the Guide for Republicans. Has WikiLeaks caused you personally to rethink or to reweight the cases that you put in the Atlantic? David has a brilliant piece. Well, to say it's a piece by David and to say it's brilliant is to waste time with redundancy. But still, he has a piece in the Atlantic in which he lays out the conservative case for Donald Trump, the conservative case for voting for someone other than Donald Trump or Hillary, and the conservative case for Hillary. Has the WikiLeaks that came out, I think yesterday was the banned email. Has that caused you to weight the arguments differently?
Not really. I mean, as I said, there's nothing. I mean, to hear Doug Band say it makes it extra disgusting. But it's not
new information.
It's not really new information. Okay. The exact figures are new, but it's not really new information. And then the fact of WikiLeaks, the fact that the case against Hillary doesn't get any stronger, and part of the case for Hillary or for somebody other than Trump is, look, we have here a hostile foreign intelligence operation aimed at affecting the American election system. And I'm not greatly swayed by endorsements, but Vladimir Putin's endorsement, that counts a lot with me. And if he is leaning this hard in favor of Donald Trump, that pushes me even that much farther against him.
Okay. About two more horse race questions, and then I know James wants to get in here. So the WikiLeaks that came out yesterday, there seems to be a little drift of momentum. Very hard to know quite what's going on in the polls. Do you expect the race to tighten?
Yes, because all these things that show a huge race all have Jill Stein and Gary Johnson and Evan McMullen at over 10%. I find that's
just not credible on election day itself.
Yeah, I think that, and I think it's never been credible. And I think those were always maybe even just statistical noise. I don't know that they ever existed, or maybe people sort of looking for ways to avoid a decision that they knew they were sooner or later going to have to make. It was going to be an unpleasant decision.
Right.
But look at Ralph Nader, who's one of the most famous men in the United States.
Yes.
One of the most admired. He got 2.7% of the vote running on the Green Party ticket. Don't tell me Jill Stein's going to get 4.
And the Ross Perot analogy is the wrong one. He got 19%. John Anderson in the Reagan-Carter race got 6%. Those are the wrong analogies?
Oh, Anderson. Yeah, no, those are right analogies, but those happened in the context of a party split.
Got it. Got it.
Although Anderson was a Republican and started as quite a conservative Republican, Anderson was the guy you voted for if you were a disaffected liberal Democrat who wanted to punish Carter for not being liberal enough.
Right.
You're a liberal Republican. But
yes.
Both Perot and Anderson appeared on presidential debates. They were there at least once.
Very good point. They got television time and no one but Hillary and Donald have. Last two questions, David, before James, who is champing at the bit, climbs in here. So would you care to call it a Trump loss by low single digits, perhaps? What do you foresee? And then my final question is the Senate. GOP keeps it or loses it?
On the Trump, I'm terrible at predictions. I'm always wrong. So,
and we'll stipulate this is an especially volatile year. 12 days from now, nobody's going to say, ha, 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 David Trump got it wrong. So, but what does it feel like to you right now?
But it feels like something in between 2008 and 2012, a bigger defeat than 2012, not as big a defeat as 2008. And probably not as high a turnout as 2008, because there'll be a lot of depressed Republicans who will stay home. But better than 2012, because the Democrats are going to be more energized than they were in 2012.
And the Senate?
I'm going to be a victim here of wishful thinking. I think it's so important that the Republicans keep the Senate, and not just as a check on a Hillary Clinton president, but also because if the Republicans only keep the House, that is going to drive the party. And this is a theme of mine, as you know, that goes back into a continuing of the cycle of radicalization. That has done so much harm.
The Senate, the rising generation in the Senate, people are aware of Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, but there are Ben Sasse and Dan Sullivan of a lot. There are a lot of impressive. I'm putting this to you as my thesis, but I want to see if you agree with it. The Senate is the place from which to rebuild. The think tanks and the journals and so forth. But between the House and the Senate, the Senate is a likelier place from which to be able to rebuild. Is that coherent enough to comment
that's
on?
Coherent. I would offer another way to think about it. But you may well be right about that. I think the Republican Party historically rebuilds from the states. And in fact, it's a sign of danger that the Republicans have found so much of their leadership in the Senate. That the Republican, and this again is my soapbox, but the Republicans also have a lot of dynamic governors. And there's some very exciting governors on the ballot this time, including I think maybe the most exciting of them all, Eric Reitens in Missouri. But what has happened is in the past half decade, governors govern. And that means they make messy, imperfect decisions.
Yes.
And then in an increasingly ideologized party, they said, well, what do you mean that John Kasich, the Washington offered him a big bunch of money and he took it? And that's bad because he broke some rule that we had and he's but that was money.
Right.
I took it. The party will become healthy again when it says that you have to look to these governors who had real world responsibilities, who have been executives. Because when you're looking to senators for leadership, it means you're not really a party of executive power anymore.
But hey, David, it's Robbie. I know Jason wants to get it. Why didn't Republican primary voters do that? They had a chance. They had three successful governors, successful conservative governors with real conservative cred, and they said no.
Yeah. I mean, I look back, I mean, I think Scott Walker was the right choice, both for political purposes and party purposes. He was the strongest contrast to Clinton on personal integrity issues. He was, he was a Northerner, but he was a conservative. He'd taken heat. He was a kind of, obviously he was a very local figure. He hadn't mm-hmm. been on the world stage. And so, that was a question about him, but he lacked charisma. He didn't have excitement. And I think one of the things that we've been spoiled by is Republicans now want, to use a Rob Long phrase, higher production values.
No, that's never a phrase I use. I always go like, yeah, Mickey, it doesn't matter. Cheap is fine.
Grainy black and white, that'll do.
When I think Northern, right?
When I think Northern, to keep.
Go on, Robin.
No, anything I don't spend, I get to keep. That's why.
You call Scott Walker a Northerner. When I think Northerner, I think of some guy from Maine or some Bostonian or something. Up here in the Midwest, I'm in Minnesota, right next to Chickenjaldo, Wisconsin. We're Midwesterners, and that's a different character than those people on the Eastern Seaboard. And I'll agree with you that Scott Walker, when it came to the television, didn't exactly have some incandescent spirit that lit the room up. He was good close up. That was just it. And in a close-up environment like we have here in the States, he did well. He's got this great little crinkly smile that I was at this small little gathering, and the women just loved it. They just loved him. But it didn't work. But yeah. You said that the rebuilding is going to take place in the state level when we got smart guys like Scott Walker to do it. But you also wrote this. In The Atlantic, you have a piece about how to rebuild the Republican Party, and there's a couple of aspects I want to get to. The first is this. You wrote, "The Democratic world today is roiled by a tide of nationalist populism. Trump is just the local American variant of a trend that has expressed itself as Brexit in the UK, National Front in France, the Alternative for Germany, and many other movements from Minsk to Madrid. The way to respond," you wrote, "is to this political tide, is not to command it to halt, but divert and channel it." Now, you can do certain things on the state, but when it comes to the national level, aren't the people who are responsible for that rising tide of economic nationalism going to regard the diversion and channeling as an attempt to blunt their influence and co-opt it? How does the national party address these issues, in other words?
Well, I may not understand the question correctly, but if you mean, should leaders co-opt this movement?
Isn't that how the people who are behind these roiling tides going to see it? If you say divert and channel it,
I hope the hell so. That's the goal. I mean, let me give you an analogy. So in the 1940s, we faced a global communist challenge. It expressed itself both in the form of an external armed threat from the Soviet Union and communist China, and also as internal subversion. Weaker in the United States, but a real challenge in Europe, where communist party. I mean, the Czechoslovakia, as it then was, fell to Soviet pressure. But at the time it fell, the communists were the largest political party inside Czechoslovakia. And had the Americans not insisted, the French and the Italians give women the vote, the communists would have been the largest party in France and Italy. How did we defeat them? Well, we built NATO. We built big armies, but we also said, let's identify some of the grievances that communists are exploiting, about the unpredictability of capitalist economies, about old age pensions and unemployment insurance, and let's see if we, within the context of our system, we can meet those grievances. And yeah, and the communists said, "Oh, this is just a bourgeois co-optation of legitimate." Right, exactly. That is what we are going to do, fellas. We're going to take away your best issue, and then we're going to arrest you and block. If you subvert, we arrest you, and we've got a big army to stop your foreign patrons. Well, that's what we need to do now, is we need to say, so, these people are really upset about too much immigration and about this not enough acculturation of those immigrants who are here. Right. Take that issue away. That people feel destabilized by trade moves and finance moves. Well, we don't want to stop trade and finance, but yeah, there are things we can do to take the issue away. And then you also meet, the genuine international challenge part of it, the Russian interference with our elections. But that's what conservative politics is all about. I mean, it is not about – and this, again, is an argument I've been having since too. It's not about standing athwart history saying stop. That you're just going to get run over. It is about saying, how do I break into the locomotive, disable the mechanism, and put it in my train?
You're a Disraeli man, really, aren't you, David?
John Podoretz once said to me, you're a Canadian who's moved to the United States and whose whole life theme has been make America more like Canada, which I thought was...
yes.
You take that as a compliment?
Agreed.
No, I don't. It's harsh, but it's a harsh, harsh comment, but it has a grain of truth. But I do think that what intelligent conservatism is about is...
You don't think what it's about? You think what it's about? you're already becoming a local. Good for you.
It is about assessing what must you change in order to preserve the things you care about most.
You know, that was so beautiful. I'm writing it down. I'm going to put up a post of David Frum's insights today. Say that again, David. I really am writing that down. That was just beautifully put.
What must you change to preserve the things you care about most?
Thank you. You know, this is – I thought we were going to be talking about the election, but what David is doing – look, I've made two notes here. You'll go crazy, we Republicans, with despair and despondency if you look to Washington. Look to the states. Look to the states. We've got a very impressive governor of Texas. Bruce Rauner in Illinois is not making much headway yet, but what an astonishing man, this wealthy businessman who would have saved tens of millions personally if he'd moved to Texas or Florida or a no-income tax state years ago.
Mitch Daniels record. The amazing,
astonishing.
Mitch Daniels.
Yep.
And people should read this, but he wrote a very funny – unsurprisingly, witty, funny book about his tenure as governor, with but also with a lot of important managerial wisdom. One of the things John Kasich did as governor of Ohio was he set up a website where you could see every check written by the state. Frankly, it's not very interesting reading, but it was just a way of making people feel like, the fact that I can know that information means I don't have to worry about it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Right. Even as – this is a strange analogy, but you mentioned the Cold War. Even as it turns out that in Hungary, the moment it became easy to leave Hungary, people stopped trying to do so.
Right. Right. So true.
Well, I'll give you the ranting from the never satisfied corner of the conservative media, because they're going to say, and this is not me saying this, I just know the argument so well, is that to change what you must to preserve what you love is that eventually what you love becomes something different. You have adapted the enemy's terms. You have adapted their mindset, their ideology, their assumptions. And you're just becoming a light version of the statist leviathan that they want to impose on everybody else. That's what they would say. So if you do that sort of incrementalism within the construct of a big government turning its tools to our advantage, you're going to have a lot of people who are already prepared to be furious after the election. And they're not going to be interested in compromise. And they're going to be interested in a lot of blame and castigation and casting out of the infidels who refused to vote for Trump. So part of the problem in rebuilding the party, it seems to me, is getting back together a collegial spirit that binds us together. Because as I said before, we thought that there were iron bands around this coalition, this big tent, and it turns out it was dental floss.
All right. There's so many things to say in response to that, and I'm conscious of the passage of time. But I'm going to say first, the idea that there's going to be
in your case, you're conscious of the passage of centuries, really, David, aren't you?
yes, I'm getting that old. Look, the idea that Donald Trump, the idea that there's going to be this casting out on behalf of Donald Trump, who is the very opposite of a conservative purist. Donald Trump is. The idea, yes, well, why didn't you rally to that great, force? That would be an intelligible argument if we're talking about a defeat of a Ted Cruz nominee. But Donald Trump is not a conservative purist. And the idea that he's been able to pull all of these people to him and to be his enforcers suggests how little interest they were in doctrinal purity. There's something else that's going on. But, this claim that, if you adapt, you lose and you drift. I think there are two core threshold beliefs that are widely shared in the conservative world. I think these two things are the single most harmful. There are two of them. But these two things together are really, really harmful and have caused so much trouble. The first is the belief that conservatives are historically losing. From my perspective, that the story of what we broadly call conservatism since the middle 70s is one basically of success, not perfect success. But if the idea was to have a less statist, more free America that lived in a world in which American power was stronger and America and the Soviet and communist threat was defeated, basically mission accomplished more or less. I wrote a whole history of the 1970s to drive home this point. If you just look at what the American economy was really like from the end of World War II until 1975, the conservatives basically won. They didn't win everything. The income tax is still there, but they basically won. And the failure to reckon with your own success leads to very bad judgment. And the second conservative predisposition that is very dangerous is this belief in the tipping point, that what happens is there's some switch that, you know, you have up to a certain point, you get politics, and then you do this thing and you trick the switch. And after that, there's never any more politics ever again. It's all over. And so since you're always trembling on that apocalyptic precipice, therefore you can never, ever make any accommodation to any kind of adverse reality. Sometimes you're losing. Sometimes you have to make your best possible deal under bad circumstances. Well, you can't do that because then you'll be over the cliff and politics will stop. And politics never stops. I met years ago a great investor who at that point was a very old man, who'd been through a lot of tough times. And I asked him, he was telling me his core investment idea: there is always something you can do. No matter how bad things look, there is always something you can do. And the trick and the way he became, you know, worth zillions and zillions of dollars was he always found that thing. And that is true in politics, too. There is always something you can do.
I can think of no better place to leave it than that.
Yeah.
People will argue and say that, yes, and every single option and tool we have in the box is a disaster. I don't agree, but it's the people who think that there is something we can do that move the country forward and keep us from going over the apocalyptic point.
As a matter of fact, David, I thought that was so beautifully stated. I recommend you retire. Just
It's over now.
Just
yeah.
Stop there.
Exactly. Go over my own apocalyptic precipice.
Tell Gabriel when you get home, or tell Danielle, that's it. You have me. Total family time from now on.
Yeah, well, some more Twitter.
Smashing the Twitter chain.
Yeah. I know we've really put you through the grinder here today, but we hope you'll come back someday and subject yourself to this.
November 9th, to be specific.
Sort
it out for us.
Thank you very much, folks. See you later, David. And you can, of course, can read them in Atlantic Magazine. And just for those people who are already queuing up their furiousness over the fact that we had on David Frum, who praised Obama for having the crease in his slacks, that was David Brooks. Different guy. But if you want a crease Obama-esque or even of military quality or just, frankly, a suit that looks good.
Oh, wow. Another
– I knew this was coming. I did actually know this was coming, but go ahead. I don't want to interrupt. Go ahead.
I just see Rob sitting there like Criswell with his index finger on his temple trying to divine exactly when I'm going to get in with a commercial. Well, it has to be done, frankly, and I'm glad to do them.
It does have to be done, and you do them – you are a professional, and that's – I mean, you were here once, and I did one, and it was just a disaster.
You know who was a pitch man, a real honest-to-God pitchman in a local sense, that he came on television, and he hawked his products in his own inexpert way with a certain sort of honesty. And at the end of it, at the end of every pitch, he would say, direct from the factory to you, and swing his hand out there because somebody told him, swing your hand and point at the audience.
Who's that?
We watched those commercials for a decade or two up here, and then we elected the guy senator, Rudy Boschwitz.
Rudy Boschwitz, right?
Oh, right.
He owned Plywood, Minnesota, and he'd get out there and pitch for it, and it was just wonderful. People forget that.
He is a lovely man, by the way.
He's an interesting character. Ran into him at a speech recently where P.J. O'Rourke came into town, and that's a whole other story. Anyway, I was telling you about suits, the importance of looking good, the importance of looking as though you've actually had a nodding acquaintance with a tailor. If you go to the store and you buy something off the rack, it's going to hang weird. If you go to an expensive shop and have somebody chalk you up, you're going to paint off a lot. Well, there is a middle ground between those. Now, Indochino is one of the largest made-to-measure menswear brands in the country, and they're making it easy for men to get great-fitting, high-quality suits and shirts at an incredible price. Here's how it works. You visit Indochino.com, or you can drop by one of their 9 North American showrooms here and there. Check the website to tell you where. You can pick from hundreds of fabrics and patterns. You can choose your customizations from lapels to pleats to jacket linings and more. You submit your body measurements, and then kick back, relax, and get ready to step into the best, most stylish suit you've ever worn in 4 weeks. So here's what happens. You do all that, suit comes, and what do you pay for it? You get some number in your mind of what you paid for the last suit that you didn't like, right? Well, here's how it goes. This week, you, our listeners, can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com if you enter Ricochet at the checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. And shipping, of course. It's free. That's Indochino.com, promo code Ricochet, for any premium suit for $389 and free shipping. 50% off. You'll never have to worry about badly fitting suits or expensive trips to the tailor again. Get ready to look like $1 million. We thank Indochino for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, sometimes here we go to a second guest, but I don't know. Why?
Aren't we guests enough?
We've had a great one, and we also have, of course, our members. The thing about Ricochet is that if you belong, if you join, you get access to the member feed where a lot of great content is bubbling up before it gets to the homepage. And let's cast our vote here. Well, this podcast is often accused of being never Trump for some reason, even though Peter is going to vote for Trump. Arizona Patriot.
I don't know that, but I am certainly not. Go ahead.
Well, you seem to be leaning in that direction already.
That is true. That is true.
But, you know, it's sort of easy in California, isn't it? I mean, like, I mean, don't you think, Peter? I mean, I hate to, like,
this is my wife and I keep looking at each other and delaying. We actually have the absentee ballots have lain on the front hall table for almost a week now. And in every other election, we vote and mail those things in to make sure we don't forget. We still have a kid at home. It gets busy here. But this time, I think we may just ignore the absentee ballots and go vote, stand in line and vote on election day, because we just frankly, it's painful to face the decision. So we keep putting it off and putting it off. But you're right. In California, my vote won't count.
Let me ask you this then. Here's the thing. And I'm the same in Minnesota, because Hillary's going to win the state, even though
but it'll count to us, right? You still find yourself weighing it, don't you, James?
Well, I do. And that's the thing, is that I understand the people who say that Hillary is awful and you must vote for Trump in order to block her. I get that. I really do.
Right.
But if you're in a situation where your vote is not to negate her, then your vote is an act of affirming him. You are making a conscious decision to endorse him in a situation where such an endorsement is not necessary. Right. And that seems to be more of an affirmation of him and his policies and who he is than it is some strategic means to block Hillary from getting the presidency.
You know,
so why would you, so if, I you think don't like, a, if you don't like him and mm-hmm. you don't like his politics, why would you vote for him?
Right.
It seems as though there has to be a logical error in there some way, but at the moment I'm having trouble. That's a pretty good argument, actually.
Yeah, I think all these arguments are sort of airtight. It really does depend on – I mean the problem with the Donald Trump candidacy is that it is a candidacy for another political system where if you get 30% of people who really passionately love you, you can win. The problem with the Donald Trump system is really the essence of the problem we're having now, because we vote by state and we're an electoral college and it's a big country and there's lots of people. Right. And I mean, at this point, I don't have any hope that Donald Trump is going to come anywhere near the presidency. And I'm glad about that, because I find him abhorrent, but I can't bring myself to give that old lady, that old crooked lady, one extra vote. So, and in California, it doesn't matter because
okay,
we know
keep,
she's going
to
carry
reasoning,
it.
Keep reasoning. When you get to a conclusion, I want to hear it.
I have no conclusion. I'm just sort of talking it out myself. But it seems to me that any way we can deprive her at this point of any support at all, meaning a mandate, the idea of a mandate,
right,
a popular vote victory that in any way echoes Barack Obama's two popular vote victories. Any way we can do that, I think that is all we can do, and that is probably pretty good too, by the way, because I think we all agree that our side needs to do some hard thinking about what it is or what our priorities are. But the DNA problem with the Trump candidacy is that the people who love him
– it's his DNA.
It was baked in. Like all the negatives he had from the beginning of his candidacy to today are the same. He's moved no needles. He's won over no one. He's lost ground. He's a terrible candidate, and he's not going to be president. But that doesn't mean that we have to love her. we should do all we can do to keep that woman from having a mandate, to force her to march down to the Senate, and I hope the House, and I hope the Senate too, and deal and compromise, and then to hold her feet to the fire. I know that doesn't sound like a rallying cry, but that is how it works.
But James, Rob, tell me if you approve of this. It has just come to me. I will write in Cliff Clavin.
Yeah, you don't want that either. Look, you could write in somebody you want. You could just leave that one blank. It doesn't matter. I mean, the vote, as long as the number of votes aren't, you know, we just don't want her to get – we want the moral repugnance of the Clinton operation and the fact that most people don't trust her to be reflected. And
right.
We want her to take office under a cloud.
That's for sure. So, so what are you – so, James, back in Minnesota, are you going to vote for McMullen? What will you do? Oh, you are? Oh, you are. Oh, I see.
Right.
Okay. That's the best.
I mean, and that infuriates people because I should be voting for Trump so he gets more numbers so she's crippled, like Rob is saying. I mean, Rob's just making the argument for saying that Trump should have an awful lot of votes in order to reduce her mandate and reduce her ability to wave a wand and get her things done. I get that. So now Rob's voting for Trump. We get that. Surprise to me. There you have it. No. Those of us, if it doesn't matter, if there's not some sort of strategic getting in the way of blocking Hillary, then you can vote your conscience and you can vote for a guy and say, well, when the numbers are tallied, let's just say that this person whose positions I agree with and whose character is a little bit a little bit shinier, more clean than the other guy, this element needs to be given some respect. That's all. And of course, the numbers will be tiny. The idea that I either – I mean I cannot vote or I can vote for a guy that I like. So I'm going to vote for a guy that I liked. I mean we had him here. You know, he went to the Minnesota State Fair and ate a corn dog. Good enough for me. But you said something there that you want her to enter under a cloud. And mm-hmm. What I love about this is there's also – I think CNN had a piece or Fox or somebody about that – you know, she could be impeached the day after she's sworn into office. And it just reminds me that a year down the road, the Hillary partisans will be calling talk radio and said that, they said from the beginning they were going to try to make her a one-term president and block her agenda, as if somehow that isn't the goal of the opposing party. I mean, that's exactly what they want to do. The idea that anybody has ever said, well, we're going to work with the new president and pass every element of his agenda, contrary as they are to everything we believe in, is nonsense. But that's how it's going to look. That's how it's going to be played out in the press. A stubborn obstructionist Republican party that can't move forward, that can't deal, that only wants to punish. That's what it's going to look like.
Yeah, the press may try. Well, okay, fine. I take your point. And the mainstream press will for sure try that. But the difference between the day after Hillary Clinton takes the oath of office and 8 years ago, the day after Barack Obama took the oath of office, will be very stark. The country knows the American people know she's – that's really what it comes down to. There won't be any long period of disillusioning. Everybody will start out without illusions about Hillary Clinton. And David Frum didn't quite make this point, but I think he would have. So I'm going
but
to
he's not here. So
I'm going to agree with him retrospectively with a point he didn't make but would have made, which is that actually is healthy. It creates a kind of political space in which the good guys, particularly these, in my judgment, this impressive new crop of senators will be able to operate. They'll be able to get out from under the big Thanksgiving Day parade balloon of the president of the United States, because in Hillary's case, it'll just be the shrunken little balloon flapping around trying to, as it bounces, scuds along the street level. It just won't be an impressive object.
I mean, the challenge at politics always say, well, you can't beat something with nothing, but you can't beat something with 27 other things either. You can only beat something with something or one other two things. You got to have two priorities, or and that's it. And so the question for the Republicans is going to be, when she's president, you know, what is the methodical, thoughtful, disciplined way to go about opposing her in on our terms rather than her terms? And the truth is that Barack Obama's done a really, really good job of making Republicans seem stupid and running circles around them in many ways. On the other hand, from the minute the House and the Senate were given back to the Republicans by the people, we stopped his agenda cold. The only thing he can do now, these extra constitutional power grabs that he's been doing, which are awful, but hard to fight and hard to manage, but that's all he's been able to do. He's been able to enact no legislation, and I think that is a creepy, sad, but still a victory. Can we talk about the two member fee posts?
Sure.
Arizona Patriot says, "I'm voting for Trump. Going forward, we need to consider compromise with pro-Trump folks on issues like trade, immigration, more help with working class. Personally, I won't need compromise much on immigration, but I'm fairly stubborn on free trade and opposition to welfare. But I recognize that working class folks have been having a really tough time. We need to be willing to bend a bit to bring them some relief, so I'll be voting for Trump." Hustler 46060 argues in reconciliation. But then there's Hillary Clinton. What can I say? Gullible at best, probably incompetent, certainly politically sociopathic. When I speak of Trump, I have to take a shower. But when I speak, can I even think of Clinton as president, I want to vomit. So when I walk into that voting booth, I broke down, compromised by principles, and voted Trump. I propose for, and I wonder if Arizona Patriot and Hustler 46060 agree, that November 9th, or maybe we'll give ourselves a day. November 10th, 10 a.m., November 10th, 11, 10, 16, we declare unconditional amnesty.
Good idea.
All Republicans, unconditional amnesty. It's all about tomorrow. That's what I would say. You did what you had to do. We made it through. On to the next.
All undocumented Republicans.
Yep.
Unconditional amnesty here.
Unconditional amnesty. Yeah. Yeah. Unconditional amnesty. We got a job to do.
Nicely put.
Well, from some of the talk show hosts that I listen to and used to have a lot of respect for what they did in the medium and don't much anymore, I think they're more interested in debathification.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Look how well that worked.
Yeah. And if you don't know how well it worked or exactly why it was necessary, well, it's a history thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
And if you want to learn history, there's all kinds of places you can go to it, but they're not very portable. I mean, you can't carry your television set around with you, okay?
That's true.
You can read Gibbons, but you can't carry the book on the light rail to the bus because it's really heavy and you can't read it while you're driving, can you? Why, if only there was some way, as Robert said.
No, there's no way. There's no way to do it. It's impossible. It's impossible. It's an unsolved problem.
Ah, but you're wrong. That brings us to the Great Courses Plus. Now, we like to learn. You like to learn. That's why you're listening to this. And we're telling you, when it comes to learning and learning services, the Great Courses Plus has a wide variety of engaging lectures taught by award-winning professors on topics like, well, history, politics, business, and even photography and cooking. You'd think on an audio podcast? Well, yes. Or video, because I got that too. It's a perfect way for people like us who love to learn to get unlimited access to over 7,000 high-quality lectures. Now, what are you waiting for? Huh? Get started now with the Great Courses Plus so you can dive deeper into areas that you learn about. For example, there's the Philosopher's Toolkit, which we keep telling you about. It's a way to improve your thinking using rational thought, visualization, social reasoning, and you can win arguments with it too. You know, it's if you had contentious elements with your relatives coming up on Thanksgiving, maybe there are a few things you want to learn so you can make that argument, keep from breaking the family apart, making everybody stare angrily at their pie. How do you do this? Well, you go to the Great Courses Plus, and you'll get a free month of free month of unlimited access to all their lectures when you sign up. So don't wait. Start your free month today by signing up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com, and our thanks to The Great Courses for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. On the way out, exit question, Claire, our beloved Claire of the editor, she's in Paris now, I believe, late of Turkey, asks, what happens if Trump refuses to concede? We went over this a couple of podcasts ago,
yeah.
I think. It was Michael Medved's scenario. he'll concede, I think, but I'll leave it to you.
You want to talk about it now? I would say it doesn't matter. I mean, the Constitution will make him will do it, and I think if it's close, and we are living in the world that we're living in, and it's close, which I don't think is going to happen. But if it's close, then he's got every right to say, "Hey, wait a minute, let's count them again," right? And in many states, there are the it's automatically triggered.
Right. I agree with everything you say. If it's not close, it doesn't matter whether he concedes areas of state, certify the election results within a certain period of days. Each state has its own rules. The results then go to the Electoral College. The Electoral College will elect the next president. Then it is officially done when the Electoral College votes. Whether Donald Trump is kicking and screaming and on the floor, pounding the floor with it, or whether he gives a gracious concession speech doesn't matter. What I hope we avoid, but which I have to agree with Rob, if there are close votes – and if there's some some indication of ballot box stuffing or irregularities, he has every right to mount challenges in any state he wants to. But boy, do I hope we can avoid another replay of Florida and counting hanging chads. But that would matter in that it would keep the nation on tenterhooks for a month. But it's not. Who knows? But I don't think it's going to be that close. To me, the likelier scenario, if you grant one whopper of a premise, which is that Donald Trump wins, grant that premise, then the likelier scenario is that Barack Obama refuses to move out of the White House. The car shows up on the morning of Inauguration Day, and Barack Obama just from the front door of the White House just sticks his tongue out. I'm not getting that limousine.
I'm sorry.
I just remember that from the end of the Clinton administration. We were all thinking, we were all whipped up by various elements, so that he was going to declare an emergency, use FEMA to put us all in the camps. And he was I mean, those who weren't there, you have no idea how much paranoia there was in the late 90s about Bill Clinton.
Right.
It was enormous because he was this devil with horned feet, cloven hooves, and a horned head who could get away with anything, which is true.
Right.
Which is why the idea of installing him back in some sort of presidential capacity is mortifying to people, even though he's a withered husk of himself right now. You were saying, Rob.
Well, I was just going to say that. Like, I mean, it is absolutely. I can say this with metaphysical certitude, as John McLaughlin would have said, that if Trump loses, as I expect he will, that he will not be gracious, that it will be begrudging, that it will be kind of a sour, nasty concession speech if he makes it. But I can also say with 100% metaphysical certitude that if somehow Trump wins, that the Barack Obama response in the transition and on that inaugural day will be haughty and graceless and equally sour no matter what. So, I mean, either way, we're going to probably see two political figures. We're guaranteed to see two political figures behave –
badly.
Yeah.
I can see
more
the Obama
team from him, but
I can see the Obama team getting a couple of cans of gilt gold spray paint and just doing the entire Oval Office, every single surface. We know it's what you want, man. Here you go. Last thing, I was wrong about that being the last thing. The Megyn Kelly-Newt interview, a little dust up. Was this an ambush? Was this revealing somehow? What exactly does this say about the state of conservative media? Apparently she's going to get $20 million a year or something, and she's not conservative. Why do people believe that Fox itself is monolithically so? Or is she going to go to another network now that she's established some sort of credibility by bucking the stream?
Well, wait a minute. It's not true to say that Megyn Kelly's not conservative. She's incredibly conservative. I mean, she's a very, very conservative.
No, she's for Hillary. She's in the tank
personally?
For Hillary.
She said she's
a liberal, a democratic liberal. That was Paul Meyer.
No.
She's
yeah.
No, absolutely.
No.
Oh
my God.
She's confrontational.
She is a political conservative. I mean, she is an out political conservative, extremely conservative.
I'm telling you. I had a friend who just went to see folks and told me that after 20 minutes, she wanted to run screaming out of the house because the television is always on Fox and there's always a news alert and there's always something on the crawl and they go to lunch and they're talking, but they go to lunch and they're listening to the radio and they're talking and they go to talk about it and it's all the same issues and they're stewed and they're angry and they're furious. I can't live like that. I don't know how people do live like that, but amongst the people who do, she is a Hillary in the tank supporter from the get-go because she's not on board.
Right. Well, that is a problem I think that Trump supporters have, where they believe that Trump gets to say anything he wants about you and you're supposed to say okay. I was at dinner with a few people not that long ago, and they're all complaining about how terrible the Bushes have been to Trump. And, you know, it's just because he beat Jeb, that's all. And
Rob, apart from anything else, I consider it significant that you were at such a dinner. You were at a dinner with people far to the right of yourself.
Well, I don't think so. What's to the right about Trump? Anyway, they insisted that it was all just about Jeb. And I said, well, wait, didn't he say that George W. Bush was complicit in 9/11? And that
he lied us into the war.
He lied us into the war, but he was complicit in 9/11, that we don't really know what he knew before 9/11. And they all kind of looked at me like, oh, yeah, but, you know, oh, yeah, okay. Oh,
that's
oh,
just
yeah.
Trump.
That's just Trump. So the idea is that he's allowed to insult you entirely, and I'm not allowed to say, oh, well, you're an insulting person. The rule is – the truth is Megyn Kelly is extremely conservative. She does not like Trump. That's clear. The debate she had with Newt was a perfect emblem of this campaign because it was about nothing, in which both of these people were arguing about nothing. And the idea that Newt was saying, you know, you're obsessed with sex. Remember, Bill Clinton, the sexual harassment stuff, they brought up. But what Newt wants to talk about is policy, because he owns that little part of the Trump, he thinks, that Trump campaign. So he'd like to talk about the stuff that's his rather than the campaign as a whole. And she didn't let him do that. I mean, in general, it's a black eye for him because she's got to show he doesn't. And he's sort of, I don't know why, allied himself with a candidate that is fundamentally opposite the Newt Gingrich's philosophy that I've known since 1993. But again, unconditional amnesty begins 10/10/16 at 10 a.m.
Fair. Fair enough. Deal. Deal.
Says the man trembling in the garret waiting for the boots, the Jacobins to come up the stairs and take him to the pockmarked wall. I will see. I'm in favor of that, of course, because I don't want to be lined up against wall and shot and pun and purged from all that is fun. And one of those fun things, of course, is Ricochet. And it's going to be here after the election if and you, you know, shell out and get some people to do so. So we need more members. We need 1,500. You can be one of them. You can get a friend to be one of them. And you can ensure that there's a place after the election and way beyond that to have a civil center-right conversation where you don't have the sewer and the bile and the vile mess that you have in most of the comment sections and other places. We're also brought to you by Sanebox, Indochina, and the Great Courses. And you can use that coupon code Ricochet in all those places for great deals. And you might want to visit the Ricochet store as well. There's a lot of great Ricochet-branded swag there if you want to swan around downtown with that R, and people will wonder why, and you'll tell them and they'll join, and we'll be here for years to come. If you enjoyed it, by the way, take a minute to head on over to iTunes, if you would, and your review, if you'd like to review it, and if you'd like to give us a multitude of stars, that'll allow new listeners to discover us, which helps keep this show going. Be one of the 1,500, and we'll see you next week. See you guys.
Next week,
thanks,
boys.
Hello, it's me. I was wondering if after all these years you'd like to meet to go over everything. They say the time's supposed to heal you, but I ain't done much healing. Hello, can you hear me? I'm in California dreaming about who we used to be when we were younger and free. I've forgotten how it felt before the world fell at our feet. There's such a difference between us and a million miles. Thank you. typical of me to talk about myself. I'm sorry. I hope that you're well. Did you ever make it out of that town where nothing ever happened? It's no secret that the both of us are running out of time. So hello from the other side. I must have called a thousand times to tell you I'm sorry for everything that I've done. But when I call you,
Ricochet. Join the conversation.